Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, it's bird news with Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
All right. You've been out and about this morning. And I guess when you keep your eyes out, you know, looking, you'll see all kinds of stuff. What are you seeing this morning? A little bit of everything.
Oh, I'm feeling productive, Mindy. I'm feeling productive. I'm like the Army or Marines or whatever. I've done more before 9 a.m. than most people do all day. I got the kids on the bus, and then, oh my goodness, there are like 1,000 grackles going through my neighborhood. This is another classic late summer phenomenon here. They just keep coming and coming. It's sort of like, it's like the passenger pigeons, but not quite the same. Oh boy, they're just zipping. One almost hit my car. I've got Mark in the car here. So these big grackle flocks go through mostly the oak forest looking for acorns and other things en masse, the sort of Hitchcockian scene at this time of year. And sometimes there are flocks of multiple thousands. So then I jetted down to Chatham with visions of a little bit of birding and fishing before the show and got to do both. The birding was more productive. As usual, it's good to have multiple hobbies, like have a backup hobby that you're doing at the same time as the less productive hobby, which is fishing. And so first I went down to Morris Island at the elbow of the Cape. And it's just one of the great, even just as a viewpoint, it's just one of the great places in Massachusetts. It's I think of it as Monomoy National Wildlife Refuge headquarters, but if you've been there, you know the buildings are all gone. They tore everything down because of erosion, and it's just a parking lot now that will, who knows how long that'll be there with the heavy erosion. But you're just looking at the sort of south end of Pleasant Bay and all these sandbars and down to North Monomoy and towards South Monomoy and looking out at the Atlantic Ocean. It's just everything sort of coming together in this one spot, and there are just tons of birds. Gulls and cormorants, shorebirds, just all over the sandbars. And one of the first things I saw was one of the iconic scenes on the outer beaches, or really any beach on the Cape and Islands in September. It was a peregrine falcon, a young peregrine falcon, just standing on the beach, just hanging out on the beach like a tourist, picking out its next victim. As this big, big, dark, young, probably female peregrine falcon just sitting there. And once it gets up and starts moving around, the shorebirds will be terrified, rightfully so. There were oyster catchers around. There was a lesser blackback gull, which that's one of the places you can expect to see this European gull that for some reason has, sort of during my lifetime, made big inroads into North America. You can see them in Florida in winter. But it's essentially a European gull. The lesser blackback gull, and Morris Island's a great place to see them. And then I went to Lighthouse Beach and I was trying to fish, but there I saw some more things that you would hope to see in Chatham in September. First, a flock of red knots. And red knots are these amazing shorebirds that nest in the high Arctic, and the one subspecies goes all the way to Tierra del Fuego at the other end of South America, and they're the ones that famously are fattening up on horseshoe crab eggs in the spring and then returning to the high Arctic. But in fall, late summer and fall, that's when we see most of our red knots here, and Chatham is the best place to see them. And they're eating little baby mussels, if they can find them, is their favorite thing, but also little grass shrimp and other invertebrates. But they're tough to find. They're not like a lot of shorebirds are sort of generalists, and anywhere there's flats, you can see semi-palmated sandpipers and semi-palmated plovers and sanderlings and things. But red knots are pretty picky, and so you kind of have to go to Chatham or maybe Chapin Beach. And I saw some of the raptors that make this time of year so cool. Two different young northern harriers, these hawks of big open places, big grasslands and marshes that start moving through here in the fall. And they're just like teetering back and forth, hunting the crest of the dunes, looking for voles or small birds or whatever. And then I was seeing this smaller raptor kind of playing peekaboo behind the dune, up and down. And it turned into a merlin, these small dark, really fast falcons. And then it like just zipped by me and started attacking one of the Harriers. It was just such a September and October kind of scene here on Cape Cod. It's just such a great time of year to see all kinds of
All
bird
kinds.
migration.
Hey, you mentioned the gulls, and we do have an email from Diane, and she says, "Today we were hiking in Harwichport at the old firehouse, newly rehabbed Cranberry Bog. Saw this smaller gull repeatedly skimming gracefully over a small pond. It was soon joined by another, smaller than a herring gull, with a red-tipped black bill. There were two cormorants fishing there as well. Tried Merlin without success," and she sent a photo, which I know you have seen. Tell us a little bit about that gull and what gulls we're still seeing.
Yes, the picture was of a laughing gull. The laughing gull is the one of the smaller than a herring gull, dark back. And then in summer they have a black head. Spring and summer, they're sort of unmistakable, and they do laugh. They laugh at you all the time behind your back. When you're not there, they are laughing at you. And their call very much sounds like laughing. But this time of year, they're away from the breeding. They breed on Monomoy mainly. But this time of year, they're on all the beaches and they're staging. They leave for the winter. Unlike herring gulls and great blackback gulls and ringbill gulls, the laughing gulls all leave for the winter and, go down to Florida like a lot of people around here. But they lose that black head, and so they just have sort of smudgy, dark gray, kind of on the back of the head. But they have that red bill and the dark back,
I think that I
and
think
they're
they're the most beautiful gull, I think. I think they're gorgeous, the laughing gulls.
they are. Oh, they're a beautiful bird, absolutely. And they're graceful too, compared to, the big brutes, the herring gulls and the great blackback gulls. They're graceful and acrobatic, and they get into these fly catching swarms that happens this time of year with ring-billed gulls and laughing gulls, essentially become swallows. They'll find a swarm of flying ants. The flying ants send out the winged alates this time of year that go off and form new colonies, and they're swarming in the air, and the gulls get onto this, and those gulls are small enough and agile enough to kind of dart around. And just eat all of these flying ants, and it confuses people. Like, what are these gulls doing? Because you can't see the ants necessarily; they're up high. Unless you see them emerging from the nest, then you're like, what the heck are they doing? But yeah, they're fly catching. They turn into big swallows basically to take advantage of that.
Something that you don't expect to see on Cape Cod is that magnificent frigate bird, right? Seen what in Chatham and Hyannis?
Yes, it's the annual migration of magnificent frigate birds by the Cape. Just bizarre. I mean, this is a very, very rare bird. It's a bird of the Caribbean. If you pay attention to birds when you go on your winter vacations, then you see them in Florida, southern Florida mainly, Caribbean islands and places like that. And across, Mexico and Pacific coast of Mexico and places like that. I remember seeing them flocked over a desert in Mexico that was right next to a beach. It's really cool. But anyway, they're very, very cool birds. They're huge, sort of piratic. They're sort of like the Jaegers that we have this time of year that come down from the Arctic and chase the terns to steal their fish. Well, magnificent frigate birds are an even bigger, much bigger version of the Jaegers in that they are trying to steal fish from other birds through brute force and intimidation and their size. And they're stealing fish down in the Caribbean from big birds like brown boobies and other things. But they don't belong anywhere near Massachusetts. They might end up in the Gulf Stream, which is very far away from the Massachusetts coast, relative to, say, the Carolinas or whatever. So we should really never expect to see magnificent frigate birds here, but we have those really strong southerly winds, and who knows where it did Hurricane Erin deposit them, somewhere a little bit closer. And but the weird thing was, I was seeing these reports of, oh, a magnificent frigate bird, and that computes, but it was a little weird. There was one in Hyannis first, Kalmus Beach, and then I was hearing Chatham, and then one spent the night on the flagpole in front of Chatham Lighthouse. And a birder named Mary Kelleher, who's always up earlier than everybody else, she was there at like 4:45 in the morning, got video of it sitting on, still sitting on the flagpole before it left at 5:30. It was never seen again. But that day before, a woman named Brandy Sikorsky, a Chatham birder, had saw three. And, you know, and then they just disappeared up into Pleasant Bay and no one ever saw them again. But she reported three magnificent frigate birds, which I have to imagine would be unprecedented. I need to check the record books, but it's just another example of why this is such a fun hobby. You know, you just, you never know.
Yeah.
Birds have wings and they get blown around and you could hit the jackpot and see the craziest thing that no one would believe. And, you know,
and if
hopefully
you
get a photo of it.
I was going to say, if you do see the craziest thing, a photo is key, right?
Yes.
We'll make sure you get that photo for sure. All right. Matt in Chilmark says, yesterday we watched a hummingbird harass three downy woodpeckers and chase them out of the yard. We've never seen a hummer interacting with other birds before. Is there something special about the downies that really get on a hummer's nerves?
Well, hummingbirds chase everything. They're just belligerent. They've got a bad attitude. It's just because they can. You know, they're just faster than everything, like everything. And I, you know, I just see them chasing all manner of large birds. I don't know what's going through their heads if they feel threatened or they think they're defending some resource. Downy woodpeckers will visit hummingbird feeders. I don't know if they got word of that. And so they're, you know, they made the list.
Get away from my hummingbird feeder. And speaking of that, we're not going to see these hummingbirds for much longer, right? End of the month, they should be gone.
Yeah. Yep. So mid-September is when a lot of them are leaving. The adults will leave first. And then, you know, we'll have young ones that are still around. And like the last few would be the first week of October is when you might see, you know, the last few ruby-throated hummingbirds. Like I have some early October records from my house here in Harwich, but they're trickling out. Like with each passing day, especially with favorable winds, there are fewer behind them as the northern forests get exhausted of their payload of hummingbirds.
Yeah, so worth it to keep the feeders going, right? I mean, and because you never know, you might see something other than a ruby-throated, right?
Oh yeah, as you know, I'm like a broken record. Keep your feeders up. Keep your feeders up. because yes, exactly, and you kind of have to keep them up into winter because that's when the interesting ones show up. Mm-hmm. You know, later in fall and winter, but they could show up earlier. You know, and it's easy enough to do because when the weather gets colder, you're not having to change the water so much.
Right.
It's not, you know, it's not getting moldy. It's, you still have to maintain it, of course. But yeah, I mean, you could end up like, you know, somebody left their feeder up and December 2nd had a hummingbird at it last year.
Wow.
And it turned out to be a really rare, black-chinned hummingbird.
Yeah. And the orioles are going to be gone as well.
Yeah, they are more likely to stay for the winter. A few, like if you go kind of hardcore birding in winter, playing your screech owl tape and, you know, Christmas bird counts and that kind of thing, you'll come across sometimes even small groups of Baltimore Orioles. But yes, but they don't leave quite as early as the hummingbirds. That you can pick them up after cold fronts in October but a lot of them probably have left already.
Right.
And the orchard orioles, the other kind of lesser known species that breeds here, they like kind of shrubby places along waterways. And they leave very early.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them are gone, I think, before the calendar turns to September.
Mm-hmm.
But the Baltimore Orioles are hardier, and they can overwinter here eating things like, you know, the persistent fruits. Some people have figured it out and actually leave their jelly feeder up all winter. I'm seeing more of that, and they might even get little groups. I've seen up to six Orioles spending the winter at somebody's Oriole feeders and putting like Dennis and Barnstable and Orleans.
Yeah.
So that,
why not? Why not? Right? I mean, you never
next,
know.
The next status, the next status thing in backyard bird watching. Like, oh, do you still? I still have my Orioles in December. Do you?
Where are yours? Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number for your bird comments, questions, or stories. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address: thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News This Morning with Mark Faraday. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We're just talking about the hummingbird feeders, Mark, but what about regular bird feeders? I know some people stop for the summer. Is now a good time if you're going to put feeders up to put them up now?
Yes. I put mine up, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks ago. And excuse me for a second here. I have seen a lot of activity at the feeders all of a sudden. And so, you know, it just seemed like the right time. The birds are hungry again. They have a lot of mouths to feed. They're still kind of feeding late fledglings and things. And there are a lot of young birds around trying to figure out how to eat. And so both at Wellfleet Bay Sanctuary and at my house, it seemed like the right time to get the feeders up. And mm-hmm. and they've been pretty busy and actually hard to keep filled over the last couple of weeks.
All right. Let's look to Tor giving us a call from Orleans. Hi, Tor.
Oh, hey, Mindy. Hello there, Mark. Good morning.
Hello, Tor.
Oh, yeah. Hi. I have some comments. A little while ago, you were talking about Monomoy and Morris Island, ideal birding areas, kind of a convergent place for so many species, including godwits. One of the treats when I worked with the museum and I was leading troops to there to Monomoy, we were watching for godwits, and the treat was to find a Hudsonian godwit. your thoughts on godwits and wonderful whimbrels? And willets, are those birds there also right now?
Fewer godwits. Like, I remember the days of South Beach when South Beach extended down from Chatham Lighthouse and it kept growing, and eventually it connected to South Monomoy. But in that was the golden age of in my lifetime of shorebirding in Chatham, and everybody was going out to South Beach, and there were always rare birds from Eurasia, shorebirds from Eurasia, redneck stints and curlew sandpipers and things turning up, bar-tailed godwits. And you could see over 100 Hudsonian godwits back then. But Hudsonian godwits have declined something like 60%. You know, this is a spectacular sandpiper. Big, tall, you know, tall sandpiper, long, slightly upcurved bill. They're just harder to find. It's harder to get your fall godwit here on the Cape. You hope that one turns up somewhere more accessible. Willets have been increasing for many years, and they're a success story. Like most shorebirds, they declined to almost nothing after the market gunning period in the 1800s, early 1900s. Mm-hmm. But they have come back with a vengeance, and there are lots of willets, and right now they're staging kind of noisily certain places. And so, like, they're a good place to see them is Forest Beach in Chatham. There are lots of staging willets and greater yellowlegs there, and sometimes a marbled godwit. That's probably the most accessible marbled godwit, which now that used to be the rare godwit, and now they often outnumber Hudsonians, which were the more expected godwit.
And what about whimbrels?
So whimbrels, whimbrels are declining too. Wellfleet was always the classic place to see them, and then they would roost on Monomoy. Whimbrels are in salt marshes looking for fiddler crabs, and so they're only in certain favored locations, and Wellfleet has, 10 trillion fiddler crabs. And so they're certainly not food limited when they come to Wellfleet. Even if as the marshes are getting degraded, they're more, more full of fiddler crabs than ever. And so these are another big sandpiper, spectacular, loud, big, long curved bill. And that bill is supposedly designed to take fiddler crabs out of burrows, which they don't need to do around here. I mean, they're just littering the ground like popcorn. They eat them at their leisure. But you know, in places where they're having to work harder to get at the fiddler crabs, and you know, out in the mangroves of coastal South America where they winter, and other places, they can use that bill to extract them from their burrows. Big, long, downward curved bill. They're unmistakable birds with a good look and kind of cinnamony tones to their plumage. And they're going from breeding sites in Arctic Canada, like the Mackenzie River Delta, up just sort of just at the base of Alaska, and then going down to the Caribbean and sort of Caribbean north coast of South America for the winter. But yeah, Wellfleet is still a good place to see them. Manomet, the research organization Manomet in Plymouth, does international shorebird work across the hemisphere, and they've been studying whimbrels for several years, putting satellite tracking devices, and particularly on young ones. And you know, we worked with them around Wellfleet on that, and that work is ongoing. And you can kind of look that up and see some of the tracks of the birds they've been tracking. Very, very cool stuff. But just a really just an amazing bird to get eyes on this time of year if you have the opportunity.
Yeah, Tor, thanks for the phone call. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. And our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, another thing we see in the fall is the tree swallow swarm. That's kind of
Yes.
fun to watch.
Yeah, I saw a huge swarm, and then Chatham's a great place for that too. Also, the dunes up by East Harbor, Pilgrim Lake, if you still call it that, up there in North Truro. But yeah, I didn't get a great estimate, but there could have been 3,000 or more
Wow.
at Harding's Beach in Chatham yesterday morning. And it's spectacular. You know, I mentioned the grackle swarms that get into the thousands. I think those are the two big swarms we see this time of year, grackle swarms in the woods, and these tree swallow swarms are more evident because they're just out in the open at, you know, dunes and beaches where people are still hanging out, and you know, Chapin Beach. There's all kinds of the dunes of Sandwich, and there's just lots of places where you can catch it. Certainly Monomoy, but you know, we don't get quite the number as amazing as these swarms are. These swirling flocks of thousands of tree swallows, our flocks pale in comparison to what they see up at Plum Island on the North Shore, and particularly down the Connecticut River, where they just, I don't know, they might get into the millions down there. As they're staging, you know, the tree swallows nest in, as people know, like bluebird boxes, birdhouses on golf courses, and things like that. And certainly at Wellfleet Bay Sanctuary and other places, they're cavity nesters. And they're still quite common and successful, and they get into these big flocks during staging time when they're sort of fattening up for migration. They don't go very far. They're not fattening up to go to South America. They might go to, you know, South County, Rhode Island, or South Carolina, or South Florida, but they're not going super far. They're sort of a short distance migrant as far as swallows go. Other swallows are going to South America because they. And the difference is tree swallows can eat bayberries for whatever reason. The bizarre of all the fruits to pick, all those juicy fruits that are out there in late summer, they could be eating viburnum. You know, they chose to eat essentially little round candles, these waxy little bayberry fruits that, you can't eat just one, but they can digest the weird waxy coating, which is made up of fatty acids, and then their bodies can turn that into usable fat. And so they, in addition to hunting for insects in these big swarms over the dunes and wetlands, they're also landing on the bayberries, and you might see this, and eating those little sort of grayish white waxy fruits.
We have an email. It's a little video. Feeding frenzy at Fort Hill. Last week, Plymouth, this week, Fort Hill, where fresh mowed fields offered plenty of tasty treats. And Fort Hill's, that's another place. It's worth just kind of driving up there just to see the view. And if you're lucky, birds too.
Right. There are always birds, and often rare ones. But yes, just the view alone, it's one of the great, it's just one of the great spots in Massachusetts. Never mind Cape Cod.
Right.
I'm watching that video, and I'm seeing the video that somebody emailed was gulls. Is that the right one? Is that the
No,
Fort Hill one?
that
That's
was a, that's not the Fort Hill one. The other one is Fort Hill. Weird.
This is the Fort Hill one.
Yeah,
It says
yep.
feeding frenzy at Fort Hill.
Yes,
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 last week
yes.
Plymouth.
There
And
you
the video is of gulls. It's what I was talking about earlier. It's like laughing gulls fly catching is what
Oh,
I see
flying, yeah.
in
Yeah.
that short video. Yeah.
Yeah, and you were, before we went on the air, you were talking about the fact that the juvenile gulls are not always that easy to identify, even for seasoned birders, right?
Yeah, right. There was a case recently where somebody emailed me a photo of a bird sitting on Race Point. And in Race Point, the birders, you're thinking of all the rare things that could be there. And so people said, oh, it's a Jaeger. But it was a young laughing gull. It was clearly a young, very close photo of a young laughing gull. And multiple experienced birders were sort of flummoxed by this, and one very experienced birder thought it was a Jaeger, but it was definitely an immature laughing gull. It's just kind of disheveled. Young birds have a
Had a
tough
rough
time of it.
night, yeah.
Yeah, it was a teenage laughing gull was out with his friends. But la young laughing gulls, I've always thought that they had evolved to where the juveniles are sort of look like Jaegers. Their plumage is very different from the adults. And they kind of look at first glance like a parasitic Jaeger. And my theory is that they have this plumage because it facilitates stealing food from other birds and helps them survive their first year. Because laughing gulls, like Jaegers, will steal food from terns. They'll steal fish from terns. It's called kleptoparasitism.
Ooh.
Try to work
Yeah.
that into your next
Can you spell
Scrabble game.
that?
Triple word score, kleptoparasitism. And so that just means they steal things from other birds. And laughing gulls do this, but a young laughing gull is going to be relatively hapless. It's learning how to live and be a gull. And so having this plumage, and I just had this as a theory. And then I was talking to, happened to be with the author, Jared Diamond, out on Monomoy. I forget why, but he and I mentioned this, like, oh, I have this crazy theory. And he's like, he's this great scholar, and he's like, well, yes, somebody posted, published a paper about that theory explaining it. And yes, exactly right, they're imitating Jaegers. And so because birds are scared of terns, are scared of Jaegers, just the sight of a Jaeger this time of year, they might just drop their fish and run. And so I think that young laughing gulls are able to kind of mimic Jaegers and take advantage of that and look scarier than they really are. It's like they're wearing a Jaeger costume and sort of robbing the terns.
Yeah. Carol in Falmouth writes, people tend to have dominant limbs. Birds don't just fly in circles, but often perch on one foot or the other. Do they have a dominant one?
A dominant
A
foot?
dominant foot.
I don't know. I don't know. I've never handed one a pen, or a baseball glove. Yeah, I have
Maybe,
no idea. It's an
maybe.
interesting
Yeah,
question. An
yeah.
interesting question, but I've never. Yeah, I.
All right. Another, Chatham's and seems to be a hot spot this week, we're talking about, but the blackneck still, tell us about that. That was what Chatham and Harwich.
Yes. Yeah, it was seen at Red River Beach, and then. Sort of the marsh behind Forest Beach is very productive. It's the outlet of Mill Creek, and there are multiple places where you can sort of view it even without having to walk all the way out. And I saw it yesterday morning, and others had been seeing it. And it stands out. It just doesn't look like anything else around here. It's ridiculously long, pink legs, black and white tuxedo plumage, very slender, long, slender bill, a little bigger than a greater yellow legs. And it was just standing on the edge of the marsh with roosting yellow legs and cormorants. But yeah, just a rare southern bird. And, it just seems like these southern birds are coming up more often. They're expand ex things are expanding their ranges north. There are things that breed in as far as New Jersey that didn't used to breed that far, I think, including them. And so Yeah, I think more and more of these southern birds, the frigate birds, the black-necked stilts, brown boobies, these things are just going to be getting more commonplace. And so, yeah, but it's still quite a rare find. And there was one in the spring that stayed for a while too. And you don't usually you don't always get two in the same year. So
No.
it's nice to have another black-necked stilt, just a
What about
gorgeous
the
bird.
what about warblers? Is this a good time to catch warblers flying through, or is it more of a spring thing?
Well, they're certainly coming through. It's easier in spring because they're singing. The fall migration, as I always say, is subtle, right? They're just sort of slipping out the back door quietly, the Irish goodbye. Catch you in the spring. And it's adults that are moving through in late August and in the first half of September. And if you spend enough time in the field and you pay attention to chickadee flocks in particular, or if you ever see a bunch of birds that are all excited about something, like in my yard, I one of the we had screech owls fledge from our box for the first time ever in the spring, and then presumably one of the fledglings came back and was roosting in the box a couple weeks ago, and we were all excited. One of the kids is back using our box again, but it was one of the gray ones, and all the local birds had gotten used to the red female screech owl. But whenever they saw the babies, they would flip out. It was very strange. It's like they're not more dangerous. I don't like that red female screech owl that you've gotten used to is just more likely to kill you than the babies are. But anyway, birds are mysterious. So they were freaking out about this gray morph screech owl in our box. And I was like, well, maybe this would be an opportunity to see a migrant. And I had like a warbling vireo was mixed in, a migrant warbling vireo, which I don't usually see in my neighborhood. So anytime you see a bunch of the usual suspects, our resident chickadees and titmice and things excited about something, go in and sort through that flock, and you're likely to get some kind of a warbler or red-eyed vireo, these sort of subtle migrants of late August and September. I had a couple of bay-breasted warblers, people had a couple Cape May warblers, black and white, but they are coming through. Our bird banding station, a banding station is a good barometer of what's coming through because, they're catching them in nets, and
Right.
it's so they get a better sample of what's out there than if you're just walking around with your eyes. And they had a bunch of red starts, I think, yesterday, Wilson's warbler, a yellow-breasted chat, which is a really nice kind of a rare one that comes through in the fall, and a few stay for the winter. So yeah, you just have to work harder than in spring. You can't use your ears, you can't use Merlin so much, which you should be using with caution anyway.
Yeah.
Then you have to go looking, wetlands and find little groups of birds that are kind of hanging out together and hope to see some warblers mixed in, but you might be rewarded. And what you're rewarded with is like almost unidentifiable, confusing fall warblers if you're not experienced. Like I was struggling with these two bay-breasted warblers I saw a couple of weeks ago in Dennis, and I'm just like getting photos of them. They're in the dark under canopy of the forest, and I got a couple photos and like, oh yeah, it is a bay-breasted warbler. But it can be rewarding, and you feel like it's a little bit more difficult, and you feel like you've done something, right? When you are able to find and identify these confusing fall warblers that are coming through now, you feel more accomplished, whereas in the spring you might be tripping over them.
866-999-4626 is our number for your bird comments, questions, stories. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News This Morning with Mark Faraday. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And this, again, we mentioned this last month, but it is a great time to see birds from the whale watch boats.
Yes, it seems like numbers of things like shearwaters have only picked up since earlier in the summer. The Dolphin Fleet did an all-day trip geared towards birders over the weekend. Had some nice stuff. We were able to go further than they would normally go on a whale watch, like further down the backside. And they had a red-necked phalarope, which is this crazy Arctic nesting sandpiper, little like all the other little sandpipers we see, except they go out to sea for the winter and just sit on the ocean, off of, you know, West Africa or somewhere. So the, and they're hard to see if you're not out on a boat. And they saw Jaegers, they saw parasitic Jaegers, they ordered a couple of Pommeren Jaegers, and hundreds, if not thousands, of Shearwaters, 500 great Shearwaters, hundreds of Cory Shearwaters, you know, these big seabirds that come from all corners of the globe, Manx Shearwaters, Sooty Shearwaters, you know, the great and the Sooty come from the southern hemisphere, and the Corys come from sort of Mediterranean and off the coast of West Africa, and the Azores, and then the Manx come from the North Atlantic, and so it was just a very productive trip, seeing all the things that you would hope to see. You know, Wilson's tons of Wilson's storm petrels, another southern hemisphere seabird, another one of the tube noses. These shearwaters and petrels are tube noses, which, unlike a lot of birds, have a great sense of smell, and they have these tubes kind of over their nostrils that I presume helps with directional, determining direction that smells are coming from. I don't know if that's been determined, but they can smell volatile chemicals given off by phytoplankton being grazed by zooplankton in the ocean. So these birds can smell productive areas of ocean many, many miles away. Because you think of, if you've ever been really far from land on a boat, you look around, like there's nothing.
Nothing. I know.
Can't see the bottom. You can't see any kind of, there's nothing
Water,
to
water
guide you.
everywhere.
Like, where it's just so how the heck do these birds survive, right? They have to find something to eat, and there might not be anything for tens of square miles. And so scent is the answer to that. And so it's cool to see these tube noses in action, and, you know, feeding over whales and things like that.
And you should
And so
tell them on the usually there's a naturalist on these boats and let them know you're interested in birds because a lot of people
yes.
go on the watch to see whales, but if you let them know, they'll point out some of these birds that you may not be familiar with.
Right. And it depending on who is on the microphone or who's on the boat, there might be someone who knows the birds, who appreciates having a birder on board to be able to point some things out. So yeah, absolutely, good reminder.
I'll talk to Carl, who's giving us a call from Falmouth. Hi, Carl.
Good morning. I'm sitting here at my looking at my bird feeder, and I have this complete collection of the common sparrows around here. Now, in the last 2 weeks or so, I have obviously a laid nest. They have the streaked chest and a big black dot on the chest, so that would be song sparrow, except they have all sorts of white on their heads, on their necks, on their chests. Could these be hybrids?
Not hybrids. I'd love to see a photo. I mean, could they be, you know, they're pigment abnormalities, or they're a funny molt. But, you know, sometimes birds are just don't produce the all the melanin, the kind of darker pigments that they would normally produce, and so you get these, people call them partial albinos or leucistic, where they're not completely white, but they're sort of patchy white. You know, often chickadees are missing some of the melanin on their heads. You see these chickadees with extra white on their backs and on their heads. I have not seen like a whole brood of song sparrows with that, so, but it would be interesting. Would love to see photos
Yeah,
if you could get
Carl, if
any.
you can get a photo, that'd be great.
I'll try. They're not being very cooperative.
No, I know
Camera
they.
shy.
I have the same thing. I have a late brood of song sparrows, or multiple broods potentially in my neighborhood, and I think the cowbirds pushed them to breed late, because all spring, all I was seeing was song sparrows raising cowbird chicks, because they get heavily parasitized by brown-headed cowbirds, who obligately nest, can only lay their eggs in other birds' nests, and they really hit the song sparrows hard. I'm like, why are song sparrows so common? I'm looking around, they're not raising any of their own chicks in suburbia. And then, so I think what happens is the cowbirds stop breeding pretty early, and they're not. So then they get a chance to raise their own young at the end of the summer. And so I'm seeing multiple young, recently fledged song sparrows hopping around on my lawn the last couple of weeks.
Carl, thanks for the call. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so Carol called, and she says she has a family of ravens in her yard, including chicks. And she hopes you can talk a little bit more about ravens.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. Ravens have been skyrocketing in Eastern Mass for 20 years or more. You know, it used to be they were heavily persecuted in colonial times and shot out, and the forests were cut down. And so they were gone. I mean, that was a bird of wild places. When I was growing up, a raven was, I never saw a raven. I assumed you would have to go to some craggy peaks in New Hampshire or Maine or whatever. You know, they were in fewer in Western Mass. But now ravens have just sort of figured out how to live in the city and the suburbs, and started nesting in like quarries and Quincy and places like that. And then it was a fire escape at Wellesley College. And then the first nest on the Cape was on a catwalk at the gas power plant in Sandwich at the mouth of the canal. And then it's been up and up from there. And so ravens are now nesting, you know, in numbers all around the Southeastern Mass and in every town on the Cape. They love water towers. If you see ravens hanging around a water tower, that keep an eye out for a nest. They nest pretty early, like late winter. They start in through early spring. And so keep an eye out for activity of ravens in funny places like that. A cell phone tower in Truro. And they may have, they were nesting on a cell phone tower at the Truro landfill, where they were kind of cohabitating with ospreys who were nesting on top. And then I think that, I don't know if the ravens kicked them out or what happened, but eventually there was just the ravens there, and the ospreys moved down to a, like a utility pole, and the nest caught on fire, and it was a whole thing. So ravens are certainly asserting themselves. Town hall in Provincetown. And that was one where they were like, well, we have to paint town hall. I think they took it down. Oh. I'm not sure that was legal. This is a migratory bird. But yeah, they're everywhere now. And where was this? Where's the caller again?
That didn't say where they were. Yeah, just said that she had some in her yard with some.
Yeah, seeing the family groups is cool. You know, they're big crows, right? They're much bigger than crows and maybe even smarter.
I was going to ask that question about their smart, because crows are very smart. So you think they're maybe even smarter?
Oh yeah, you know, there's a classic. Well, I don't know. I haven't like sat them down to take the SATs, but there's a great book, Mind of the Raven by Bernd Heinrich, this great naturalist and professor from up in Maine. Has written a number of books, Winter World. Great author on natural history, and he followed these ravens around and wrote a great book about them. But yeah, they've given them intelligence tests. But when you get the young ones, it's just fun, because at some point in the summer, the young ones are still hanging around. And I remember last year I was bumping into in Eastham, somewhere in the kind of industrial parks of Eastham. I don't know where the nest was, but this family group was hanging around in the power lines, and the young ones make these higher pitched calls that are sort of fun and follow the adults around. But yeah, it's extra special to have the family groups around. I mean, we're certainly seeing more ravens everywhere now, but very cool to have the whole family hanging around your yard.
Sure. All right. Nancy's giving us a call from Centerville. Hi, Nancy.
Hey, how are you guys? I enjoy the program. Hey, I feed the birds a lot, and I have a lot of birds that come to the feeders, but also there's a group of mourning doves that comes by, and there's one that has like shown up the last few days, and it looks a little deformed on the beak, and it has like almost like a tick on the nose. I don't think that's what it is, but is that a bird that can infect other birds? Is it some kind of sickness that it has, or what's going on with that? Any idea?
Which species was this again?
Mourning dove.
It's a mourning.
Oh, a mourning dove. Yeah, birds can get bill deformities and viruses and things. I I can't think of examples with it happening to mourning doves. There are people, if I had a photo, there are people I would consult who, you know, like the bird rehab folks, like, you know, Stephanie Ellis at WildCare and her staff, or Cape Wildlife, or even Sue Finnegan, the bird bander. I'll often send her pictures because bird banders get these up close looks, and they sort of have a catalog of the different bumblefoot. You know, there are these different conditions that birds get with beak deformities and foot deformities and things like that. And those people have a better handle on it than I do. And I don't, with mourning doves, it's hard to say, but I would love to see a photo. Hard for me to say.
Yeah. So if I get a photo, where should I send that? I'll do that. I
You
can get a
can
photo.
send it either to Mark at Mass Audubon, or you can send it here and we'll send it on to Mark. thepoint@capeandislands.org. Happy to send it on.
Okay,
All right.
great.
Yeah.
Thank you so
Thanks,
much.
Nancy. All right.
I just make yeah. So do you think it's I should keep it like stop feeding so that do you think it could infect the other birds or probably not or not a factor?
I can't say. So, I mean, morning doves usually just are by themselves on the ground. Is it going on a feeder?
Well, no, it comes to the deck, and there's usually, three or four mourning doves that are around the yard, and they come together and come get seeds that I tossed out there. So it comes up
Yeah,
close, and it's still eating and walking. Everything else looks normal.
there's something called avian keratin disorder that I don't know if that would be catchy, but so, I mean, mourning doves hang out together anyway, and they, as the fall goes on, they get into bigger and bigger flocks, and you often see them together gathering under feeders in a little flock at the end of the day. So, you know, you can't really stop them from hanging out together. I would be very surprised if this was something it could pass on to another bird, but it's up to you without knowing the situation there. It's not likely to be, you know, like with a house finch eye disease, that's a situation where the house finch is like rubbing its face on the, you know, you think of a tube feeder, like it's definitely potentially passing on pathogen to other birds. And so the recommendation is to take the feeder down, you know, wash it in bleach, that kind of thing. But a mourning dove that's sort of hanging around on the deck, I don't think that's a big high risk situation.
Yeah. All right, Nancy, thanks. Thanks for the call. We were talking earlier about Monomoy, and it used to be easy to get out there and go birding. Not as easy as it used to be, right? I mean, it's tough to get out there if you don't have your own boat.
Yeah, right. The shuttle services that people used to use in South Beach are just gone.
Yeah.
I mean, it evaporated, it washed away, and it's been kind of what used to be South Beach kind of got pushed west towards North Monomoy, and North Monomoy is no longer as protected as it was, and so that's eroding away, and everything's changing down there. So it is, yeah. You kind of need. There are some shuttle services. I think a lot of people are getting friendly with people with boats, birders,
Yeah.
or getting friendly with people with boats to get themselves out to Monomoy a couple times during the summer. But yeah, the days of the shuttle service, you can just hop on and go out to South Beach or North Monomoy or whatever, are mostly gone. There's something out of Stage Harbor that's worth checking on. You know, you can still Google around and see if anybody is still doing Monomoy shuttles.
Yeah.
I don't know if Outermost Harbor is doing anything anymore.
And as I said, it's an active time, so we have like less than 30 seconds left. Get out there, most beaches, right? It's a good time to check out the shorebirds, right?
Oh yeah, just go anywhere and pay attention. This is such a great time of year for birding, and not as many tourists, and better weather, and everything is just great. Get outside.
Get outside. All right. Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary, joins us the second Tuesday of each month. Thank you, Mark.
Catch you next time.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.